Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When we sign papers to buy a home or a piece of land, what exactly are we buying? And what rights do we have to prevent other people or the government from taking it? Owning property and the right to exclude others from it is essential to the way Americans think. And it's complicated, as Howard Mansfield writes in his new book. The book is called The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down, and Howard Mansfield joins us now. Howard, welcome to The Exchange.
Good to be here, Peter. Thank you.
And listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about property rights. We're going to jump right into this. We'll be taking questions and comments about eminent domain, the history of the United States, and property rights. We'll talk about all these things. If you are a property owner and you've been asked to sell your land to a company or the government, or if your land was taken by eminent domain, we'd love to hear from you at some point in the program. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page. That's NHPR Exchange, all one word when you search on Facebook. All right, Howard, so let's start at the beginning.
Sure.
And you start this book with scenes of your interactions with Native Americans in the Sonoran Desert, whose ancestral land was taken time and time again by companies, European colonists. We know from our history teachers that Europeans weren't very nice to the Native Americans and their way of life. Can you describe for us, before you get into the details of what you saw in the Sonoran Desert, sort of the essential differences in the way this group of Native Americans viewed land and the way European settlers viewed it?
Yeah, you know, there's a key moment in 1628, the Puritan John Winthrop says, the Indians have no settled habitation, nor do they enclose any land, nor do they have any tame cattle by which to improve the land by. So like the Narragansett, the Wampano, the Abenaki, they're moving all over the place. And the English, the Puritans, just can't figure this out. It just vexes them because they come from a very bounded world. They come from the world shaped by feudalism. They come from a land of boundaries, stone walls, surveys. And so therefore, in the Puritans' eyes, the Indians were not following the famous injunction in Genesis, I think 1:29, to subdue all the living creatures and have dominion over every living thing. And therefore, to them, the Indians had no property, and therefore they had no property rights. A key distinction. Even though the Indians were living here, you know, for eternity, they had no property rights. And this was reinforced. There's a lot of treaties. There's a lot of back and forth. But there's a key Supreme Court ruling, 1823, in which the Supreme Court of the United States defines the Indians off the land, saying that the Indians really only have a, quote, right of occupancy, end quote. They were only, quote, tenants at will, end quote. So hence, their tenants were the landlords, which is a pretty good setup for us. And that was the attitude.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that sets up, it seems to me, a situation where might makes right in the sense that the Indians clearly disagreed.
Yes. Basically, you have a couple of hundred years of policy towards the Indians in which whatever variation it is, it's essentially, as a chief speckled snake said, whatever it is you're telling me, it's always get a little further from me. Mm-hmm. So whatever it is, the Indians lose out. Treaties are drawn, treaties are broken. Settlers had a habit of buying the land before they were even off the land. The Indians were off the land. The preemption rights, George Washington, among others, would trade these rights to buy this land once they were sure the U.S. Army would clear them off.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your experience in the Sonoran Desert. What were you there for, and what did you take away from that experience?
So I was out on the reservation of the Tohono O'odham. If you're of a certain age, they were on the map in your elementary school as the Papago Indians. The Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum was having this walk to reconnect the Tohono O'odham with their native foods and their native ways. They have one of the highest rates of adult onset diabetes in the world. They have tremendous poverty, tremendous problems. Their reservation, by the way, is the size of Connecticut. It's at the bottom of Arizona. It doesn't seem possible to you to go home and like put your thumb on Connecticut and move it across your map all the way over there. So we were walking along in the desert. They had started in Mexico. And the Sierra Cortez and their tribe there called the Kumkak or the Seri were traditional partners of theirs. And they would go back and forth until the border was drawn. And then the border obviously had hardened. And it broke up a very traditional way of life. So I'm walking along one day there and I realized, oh, my God, I'm in the Gadsden Purchase. Now, the Gadsden Purchase is the last bit of land added to the continental United States, 1850-something during the presidency of Franklin Pierce. And it was bought solely so that they could find a route for a southern transcontinental railroad. So two things about this. One is this is somebody's land deal, but to the Tohono O'odham, the desert people, as that translates, this is their sacred land. So a land deal or a sacred land? Sacred thing. Now, if you look at the map, the maps we grew up with in school, it's just a blank space. The boundaries are what are important. No, none of the details are there. That was the realization that struck me.
Mm-hmm. And this is part of the idea that carries throughout American history, and comes up repeatedly in this book, which is that precedence goes to the exuberantly active citizen over the quiet citizen, and that Americans believed that property in motion takes precedence over property at rest.
Yes, these are the two key ideas that really distinguish property in America. You got to remember, right before coming from a feudal world, in feudalism, you cannot sell land. Land, if the family has it, land is the family. You know, it's like endless masterpiece theater things. You can't sell the land. And with that comes this incredible tangle of feudal privileges and rights, things we never heard of, escussage, burgage, francomelian, avowance, and ties to the clergy, corridy, primogeniture, dignities.
We've lost you.
Yeah, exactly. Who ever heard of these things?
Right.
What are they? And before the revolution, they vanished. They're gone. And compare all that to the American system, which is a sign in a lot by the highway that says 1 acre, zone commercial, will build to suit. Land becomes a product. Buy it, sell it, use it, move it. Just keep it moving. The great historian of the revolution, Gordon S. Wood, he says, indeed, the entire revolution could be summed up by the radical transformation Americans made in their understanding of property. The entire revolution. So this is a radical break. And what this break emphasizes is property in motion. And something you just quoted, which is from an 1895 legal textbook, which says the quiet citizen must keep out of the way of the exuberantly active one. In other words, economic development, property in motion, has the right of way. And when a big project is bearing down on somebody, a pipeline, a power line, a windmill farm, a highway, all of a sudden the burden of proof is on the quiet citizen, someone there just planting dahlias and playing soccer with their kids. The burden of proof is on them to show why they should stop property in motion. And it's entirely backwards. It should be the other way around. The big project should have to prove its worth. So all of a sudden, these property owners who feel like they had something solid, you know, this mortgage, we call it real estate after all of a sudden they are now tenants at will. They are the Indians in a sense. Mm-hmm. They only have a right of occupancy. And that's the pain that I saw when I went and talked to people who were facing Northern Pass or facing that Kinder Morgan pipeline in western Massachusetts. They couldn't understand, how do we get in this situation? Why is the burden of proof on us?
And we're going to get to that as well in this program. So if you have questions or comments about those particular things, or if you'd like to challenge any of Howard's assertions that he's making here, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Howard says, bring it on. We'd love to talk with you about this. Let's stick with colonial days for a moment, though,
sure.
Because it's such an essential part of American history that you mentioned just now that it was changing around this time. Part of what changed is that more people could own land, right? I mean, this was different from the aristocracy in Europe.
Well, exactly. Over in Europe, you have a lot of labor, no land. Here you have no labor, very little labor, tons of land. And the founders of Washington, Hamilton, Madison, Morris were huge land speculators looking after tens of thousands of acres, constantly trading back and forth, trying to build their wealth. And it was essential in this idea. In the colonies, when you're reading about liberty, you're reading about property. When you're reading about individual freedom, you're reading about property. And when you're reading about the framers of the Constitution trying to create a government of divided sovereignty, you know, checks and balances, federal and state powers. Mm-hmm. When you're reading about that, you're reading about institutions set up to protect property because they believed in stability. They believed stability would protect us from tyranny. And at the time, as you know, only white males with property could vote. But property is key. Property is liberty. Property is the pursuit of happiness. It's tied up. It's totally tied up right from our founding.
Mm-hmm. How significant was it that maybe ordinary people, even though they were just white men, could own property?
This was a big change. This is why when people came over here with schemes to try and run things on the feudal model where you would rent land, it failed. It's also key to understand, again, if the Indians had no property, look at their standing. And at the same time, Africans brought to this country against their will are considered to be property. And it's important to know that slavery, even though that word is not exactly used, but slavery is the one type of property that's talked about most in the Constitution, far above any other kind of property. So from the start, Indians have no property and Africans are property, and then white males can own property. So it sets everything on its course right there.
Mm-hmm. And part of the sort of settling of New Hampshire, I think, is relevant to talk about in this discussion because you mentioned feudalism.
Yes.
And one of the people who tried to sort of import feudalism here in New Hampshire was Captain John Mason.
Yes. In 1629, he gets a grant of land from King James I. And this land, it's defined as like being maybe 60 miles from the mouths of two rivers. Now, you've got to understand that maps are really bad then. The deeds are drawn having mythical rivers, having mountains in the wrong place.
Well, these people weren't even here, right?
They weren't here. No, they were at a council in Plymouth, England.
Yes.
And they claimed that. So that's the first thing you've got to understand is why do they get to own this?
And also they were measuring with chains and necessarily precise.
Yeah. Well, actually, the surveying was pretty precise.
Oh, that was okay?
But
right.
It's this idea that you could just claim this and own this. So his idea is to set up a realm, a feudal realm, and collect rents in perpetuity forever in this land he calls New Hampshire, based on his home county in England, Hampshire. It's a failed business plan. It's a failed business model. But what it does is it ties the colony, the New Hampshire colony, up in knots for 150 years. It's in and out of the courts, in the royal courts, and then in the courts in this new country, America, back and forth across the ocean. And it affects the boundaries that we have today. It affects where Massachusetts and New Hampshire are. In fact, the last case that was even related to it happened about 2000, 2001, went to the U.S. Supreme Court about whether the naval shipyard was in Portsmouth or in Maine. Mm-hmm. That's related to that deed. So it has this phenomenal effect on the colony. And you can see it today on the maps of New Hampshire. If you look at the town boundaries, particularly out in the Monadnock region going north, you'll see that some towns seem to curve or seem to bend. That's because it ended up, and no one knows quite how, this was decided that his property, his claim, would be defined by a curving line. And it's really, there's only two curving lines in the entire American continent. The entire continent have been surveyed that way. There's like a small one north of Delaware, and there's this. And it's a very strange story how they keep extending it by deciding it's an ellipse, by using nautical miles, each time claiming more and more.
But it's fascinating. I mean, if you put Portsmouth, say, in the center of a clock, from 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock, there's like a curve from, I can't remember what the 9 o'clock is, but is like the 12 o'clock like around Jackson, New Hampshire?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, it curves around. Yeah, and this claim, really, a key moment, Massachusetts tried to use that claim against New Hampshire to kind of claim land all the way up past Concord, around Concord. As you know, Massachusetts laid out Concord's Main Street.
And that is actually something I don't think many people know. I thought that was really fascinating. Massachusetts laid out Concord's Main Street, on which the State House sits.
Exactly, exactly. So there you go, Taxachusetts right there. So they lost in the court of in the royal court over there. Massachusetts lost because the Puritans were so obnoxious to the English that they wanted to just control their power.
Listeners, this is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoi today. We're speaking with author Howard Mansfield, whose new book is all about the idea of property and land ownership in American life and in history, all the way up to present day. We're going to be talking about eminent domain later in the program, as well as climate change. What do you think about property rights in America? Our number is 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Paul on Twitter mentioned property ownership comes with a bundle of rights, including the right to buy, sell, or lease. And he put lease in all caps. Towns that are looking to restrict the rights to do short-term leases are challenging the most basic of property rights outlined in the Magna Carta. So that's the comment from Paul on Twitter. Howard Mansfield, your thoughts on Paul's comments about the property rights outlined in the Magna Carta. Where do those come in?
Well,
are you familiar with those, first of all? They were mentioned in the book. So.
No, I don't mention the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta is just this big laundry list of everything. We always think it's like this grand magisterial document. I mean, it's like where you can where the serfs could like graze their cattle. It's just like everything, but it does. It's the beginning of property rights. You can tell it's a contentious issue with people anytime you start limiting what they perceive their property rights to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's sort of legal now to put covenants and restrictions on places, and certain condos, for example, say, look, if you buy into this condo association, you can't have short-term leases, for example.
That's if you go back to the colonial era and the pre-colonial era, there were all sorts of restrictions on property. Your property could be taken in New England, for example, if you did not develop it for a mine, if you did not develop it for a mill seat, if you did not build on your land within a certain number of years, it could be taken back. So that has always existed.
The idea that improvements is part of ownership.
Exactly.
Quote, unquote, improvements.
Yeah. Well, the idea you're trying to create wealth for the community.
Yeah.
That's how they saw it.
Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We were talking just a moment ago about Captain John Mason and Mason's Curve through New Hampshire. Essentially, his experiment didn't work out. Why not?
Well, you can't rent land. You have to sell it. That's what the Masonian proprietors, who eventually bought his claim right before the Revolution and laid out a lot of the towns we know today. They thought they were buying 200,000 acres. It turned out they ended up like with 2 million acres or something. He just had a bad business model, but he persisted through the generations, through his grandsons, his great-great-grandsons. It's a crazy story.
Mm-hmm. Among the founders who were big into property rights and ownership is George Washington. We sort of learned in grammar school that he was a surveyor. This seems to be one of those things that, oh yeah, he was a surveyor, but then he went on to, you know, fight in the Revolution, then he was president. Those are the big things. But actually, being a surveyor for George Washington was huge when it came to shaping his worldview, as you write in this book.
Yeah, Washington started with nothing. In fact, at one point, he didn't have enough money to buy corn for his horse. But he became a surveyor, and he saw that a lot of families in Virginia, which was totally a land-crazy, land-hungry place, were getting rich by buying the backlands, as he called it at the time. And very early on, he made his first purchase of some 2,000 acres in the Shenandoah Valley. And then after fighting in the French and Indian War, the soldiers were given what were called bounty lands in Ohio. And Washington did a lot of sort of double-dealing and back-dealing and having representatives by him, front for him, to get those grants away from other soldiers until he ended up with about 30,000 acres in Ohio. And at the time, you weren't supposed to have more than just a little bit of river frontage. He ended up with like 30 miles of river frontage. Mm-hmm. So his whole life, he's constantly buying and selling, and as are most of the other founders. And his whole life, he's short of money. He ends up with like 8,000 acres at Mount Vernon, and he's still short of money. When he leaves the presidency after two terms, he has to like sell some land to put in some necessities for the family. Mm-hmm. So tremendous overhead, but he definitely saw land as the key to wealth. And it's also important to understand his view. One is you're investing in the country. You're building the country. And two is the federal ideal. The Federalist ideal is that a gentleman, the proper way for a gentleman to get money, to be in government, was to collect rents on land. That was like clean money.
Tell us about his experiment trying to improve quite a bit of swampland.
Okay, yes. In the 1760s, just before the Revolution, Washington buys 20,000 acres of swamp, and the Great Dismal Swamp, and yes, he wants to drain the swamp. The Great Dismal Swamp was this vast primeval cypress swamp on the border between Virginia and North Carolina. Washington thinks it's going to be good farming land. So he and about 20 other investors get together, form the adventurers for draining the Great Dismal Swamp. And they get a lot of slave labor, and they put them in there, and they start trying to drain the swamp, trying to dig canals. And the accounts are just gruesome, and slaves are dying, and they just keep importing more slaves. And it never turns a profit in Washington's time. And it turns out to be bad farming land. And eventually they end up building a canal and cutting shingles for the roofs that are on houses, cedar shingles, shakes, on houses in Philadelphia, Boston, and New York.
Hundreds of 100-year-old trees down for shingles.
Hundreds and hundreds of years old trees. Yeah, yeah. And today, the Great Dismal Swamp is maybe about 10 to 50% of its original size, and they're trying to, quote unquote, re-wet it and trying to, because it turns out peat is a tremendous store of methane, and, you know, it'd be a great fight for, you know, great carbon reserve.
So a failed business venture on Washington's part, but in some ways a metaphor for what Americans, especially wealthy Americans at the time, were trying to do, trying to improve the country by improving the land.
In fact, there's something called Washington Ditch, which is the first canal they built. That's actually the oldest monument to Washington in the country. It's this long ditch through the through the swamp.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And still to come, the story of Romaine Tenney, the Vermont farmer who made good on his threat to die at his farm before he allowed the government to build an interstate through his property in 1964, and how echoes of Romaine Tenney can be found in the voices of people who said no to big checks from Northern Pass. What do you think about the way American culture teaches us to think about property? Are we obsessed with it to an unhealthy degree, or is it the cornerstone of our social and financial lives? Maybe it's both. What do you think? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended.
That's why Bear Brook, the latest podcast from NHPR, has been downloaded more than a million times.
30 years ago this month, a mystery began.
It's the story of a decades-old cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever, reported by NHPR's own Jason Moon.
This story is not going to go the way you think it is.
Download it now or check it out at bearbrookpodcast.com.
Coming up tomorrow on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We'll be speaking with our guests about the week's news. So if you have questions or comments about the week's news, be sure to listen live at 9 tomorrow morning or write to us now. We will definitely be talking about the race for Speaker of the New Hampshire House, among other things. Again, send us a note. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. But right now, we are talking with author Howard Mansfield about his new book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. That document you signed saying that your house is yours? Well, how powerful is it? Does it protect you against all circumstances? Or is the idea of property fiction that with brute force becomes fact, as our guest writes? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to talk a little bit about the Weeks Act in this section of the show. We'll talk about Romaine Tenney, Northern Pass, the Kinder Morgan pipeline that was to be, but is no longer to be. But first, let's get this comment from Nick. Nick says, great topic today. Your guest is pointing out one of the key issues we need to grapple with in the U.S. and Canada if we want to get to work on a more sustainable path. Some of the indigenous leaders I work with refer to the transition to our private property regime as a, quote, invasive land ethic. Our private property rights systems in the U.S. and Canada and eminent domain projects are significant obstacles to indigenous nations' collective continuance. Tribes and First Nations need autonomous control over significant territories to make space for their resurgence. Indigenous leaders can offer some guidance to a more sustainable land tenure system. Weaving Western science and indigenous knowledge can help us find solutions to very complex socio-environmental problems facing our society today. That's the comment from Nick Rio, who is Associate Professor of Native American Studies and Environmental Studies at Dartmouth College. Howard, to you, what do you think of Nick's comments?
I think Nick is right. I think it would be good if we would examine how our attitudes towards land affects what we think of the native peoples and how they're right at the founding. And it's the two things don't really go together. And I think he said that very well.
And while we're on the topic, let's go to Jahan of Northwood. Jahan, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, thank you so much. I would just seem to echo, I didn't hear Nick's comments, but I echo the same, that it's impossible to think about land in the United States and not think about the indigenous people that occupied the land before it was stolen. And I think it's especially important to consider our education system, and I love your show, and I love that you're bringing these questions to light, because there are all kinds of creative solutions to sharing the land and redefining what property means, and and how do we have shared sovereignty and some concepts that obviously originate with indigenous ways of thinking about things. So I think Nick probably said it all, although I missed it, but that's sort of the same line of thinking I had. So,
well, can I ask you a follow-up question?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
You mentioned something about education. What role do you think education plays here?
Oh, I think it's a critical role. I think that the way children are taught about land and how America was discovered and all of these myths have to be sort of reexamined, and for us not as Americans not to fear new ways of thinking and approaching the conversations about things that we've been sort of entrenched with.
Well, Jahan, thank you very much. Sorry about that. I really appreciate your call. Thanks very much. So, Howard, what do you think?
I think I agree with what she has to say. I think it would be great if the Native presence were taught in the schools. And I think in American history, you know, in astronomy, sometimes you talk about there's these dark matters and these dark stars that are bending light and bending gravity, and you don't know what that is. Well, to most Europeans, to most white people, that dark area is the Native presence, and that's bending, that's affecting the history, and we need to see that. And I really like that attitude that she expressed.
I'm glad we get a chance to talk about that. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the idea of property in American society, 1-800-892-6477. Howard, I want to ask you about the Weeks Act, because you write in this book about how much you love the Weeks Act.
It should be a holiday.
It should be a holiday.
We should have a holiday for the Weeks Act.
Well, why do you think that's the case?
The Weeks Act was a tremendous victory. At the time, I think a lot of your listeners know the White Mountains were just burned over. Parts of the White Mountains look like those photos you see of Gettysburg and Antietam, you know, after the battles, just burnt over stumps. There was so much runoff that the rivers were flooding and the Amiskeg mills, the world's largest cotton mills, had to shut down. It was an ecological disaster. Well, it took a small band of reformers, I think it was like 9 people, 10 years to find the open sesame, to find the way to preserve and to restore the White Mountains.
And for those who aren't familiar, when was this taking place?
Beginning of the 20th century.
Okay.
And the Weeks Act was finally passed by Congress in 1911. Under the stewardship of John Weeks of New Hampshire. The magic word, by the way, was property. So they suffered 40 Senate votes. They lost 40 Senate votes. They lost 40 times. The leader of the Senate at the time, Speaker of the House, said, not 1 cent for scenery. You know, not 1 cent for scenery.
Meaning we're not going to spend government money just to make pretty views.
No pretty views. And the argument wasn't one on forest management, and the argument wasn't one on tourism, and the argument wasn't, the argument was one on protecting property. By protecting the watershed north of the mills, we would protect property down from the mills. So essentially what you have is learning to protect private property creates this great commons. And as from the Weeks Act, we get 50 forests, more than 50 national forests east of the Mississippi. And the Forest Society, the Society for the Preservation of Hampshire Forests, was key. This was one of the key acts at their founding. It's one of the things we could thank them for. And why it's important to us is this. Here's a model of a group facing what was an insurmountable problem, staying at it and finding the way to solve it. And we're at the same point with climate change. We haven't found the open sesame, the words to kind of have some kind of public coming together to actually deal with this. We haven't found it. These folks, these reformers did. So I think that's another reason why we should have a holiday for the Weeks Act. It's a great act. As troubled as our national forests are in some other ways, it's still a tremendous achievement.
One of the things you write about here, and correct me if I'm wrong in any of these details, but is that, yes, the Weeks Act is able to sort of preserve some of the land, but there's also a separate part of this, which is that the mineral rights.
Yes.
So you can essentially preserve the land on its surface, but if there's valuable stuff underneath that land, that stuff can still be held privately and accessed by private companies or individuals.
And this is the sad part of it. 50% of land held in our national forests are private. This is not the case with the White Mountains. And the mineral rights, that's considered in law to be a dominant right, so I can come onto your land and drill or mine for the minerals. And this is going on in the national forest, particularly over in the Allegheny Mountains over in Pennsylvania because of fracking. I mean, there's thousands of wells in some of our national forests. So that's a problem. They didn't buy the mineral rights at the time they bought some of the other rights.
Hmm.
And that's a classic example, again, of how our attitude of private property shapes the land. I think I say in the book someplace that property is the air we breathe. It's like invisible, and yet it shapes our attitudes about everything. It shapes even what we think it's possible even to think about. That's how deeply ingrained it is. And that's what we should kind of come to learn.
Mm-hmm. So in the case of the National Forest here in New Hampshire, is it possible that if something valuable is discovered under that land, that then once again, those mineral rights will take precedence and bad things will happen to the mountains?
I don't know if specifically if that's the case with the White Mountains per se, but it's the case with so many other national forests.
I imagine that's a scary scenario for people who really like the White Mountains.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's the case there.
Okay, open question. Listeners, if you have insight onto that, give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. Want to bring in a few comments from listeners who've been sending us emails. Thanks for those, by the way. Howard, don't know if you know the answer to this, but worth asking. Amy in Derry emailed to say, I seem to remember hearing that one of the motivations for the Salem witch trials was land grabbing by one or more families. To your knowledge, Howard, is there truth in this?
I don't know.
Does that sound like something that Americans would do?
Yes, it does. I mean, there's a lot of theories around the Salem witch trials, and it's a fascinating story. I've never heard that particular one put forward.
Mm-hmm. And Michael commented, as a farmer, I can tell you that land not only represents a place, but life's work and a vision of the future. Eminent domain not only removes someone from their home, but erases someone's body of work. Michael, writing as a farmer, common sentiment, Howard.
Yeah. Eminent domain is essentially a fire set by the state. It destroys what people had invested there. You have almost two different things overlapping. Property, which is a set of rights. It's boundaries. It's my right to keep you out. And you have land. And land can sometimes be a very different thing. Land is joined to other land. Land is an ecological idea. Land is something we give our allegiance to. So sometimes that's what happens. Those two values clash.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about eminent domain and some of the people who have had notable clashes with it. Among them, a man named Romaine Tenney. You tell the story of Romaine Tenney in this book. You spoke to some of his family members several years ago to write this. Tell us about Romaine Tenney. Who was he and what happened?
Okay, this is a rather sad story. Romaine Tenney was a bachelor farmer living in Ascutney, Vermont, just across the river from Claremont, New Hampshire. He ran no machinery on his farm. He had no electricity. He milked 50 to 60 cows by hand. He cut his hay with workhorses. He had no electricity in the house. He was essentially a bachelor farmer, and he kind of held that office in town. Everybody knew him. Everybody loved him. In 1964, the interstate's coming up the Connecticut River Valley and goes right over his farm. He says, I'm not going to land. I was born, I'm not going to leave. I was born here. I'll die here. I am not going to leave this land. I love this land. It's 90 acres of beautiful hayland farming. So what he does one night, at the very end, as they're dynamiting and bulldozing all around him, and the sheriff has come with an eviction order, and they pulled everything out of the barns and piled it up, is at night when no one's around, about 2 a.m, he set everything on fire, shot himself, and committed suicide. Totally shook up his neighbors. Still upsetting today.
And it made national news. He sort of became a symbol for the lone American who's going to stand up against the government, who's trying to take what is rightfully his.
He became, for a lot of people, the Vermont farmer they wanted to find. They wanted that kind of steely independence. That wasn't what he was doing, really. He just loved the land. He just loved his animals. This is what he knew, and he couldn't believe it was being taken away from him.
Mm-hmm. And as you write here in the book, there's sort of echoes of his story in the story of Lynn Placy, sort of a modern-day Romaine Tenney, although she did not set fire to her own home. She was the woman who taught piano out of her home in Stewartstown and decided not to sell to the Northern Pass Project, even though her nephew did, and she turned down quite a bit of money.
She did, certainly, as did her neighbor Rod McAllister, who said no eventually to $4 million, and he's a dairy farmer. He could have used it, and he said, not listening. My roots are deeper than your pockets. So here you have a case where you bring this, so the Romaine Tenney resistance forward from 1964 to just recently. And these folks organize, these folks resist, and to this point, 8 years on, have stopped Northern Pass. It's in appeal in the courts, but the SEC has ruled against Northern Pass. So they made a successful stand against it by being model citizens, by speaking their minds, by speaking to their elected representatives, and by learning all about the technological justification for the project and refuting it.
Mm-hmm. And in your view, do companies typically back down because of local resistance? Does the strength of the resistance matter? Or do local companies simply look at the bottom line and see, or not just local companies, but national companies, do they look at the bottom line and see, is this going to be profitable? And is the answer, if the answer is yes, they'll just plow forward? Or is there some sensitivity to local sentiment?
It obviously depends on the company and the situation, but it takes a lot to get a big project stopped or to get a big project rerouted. It's a shame that a lot of these projects don't start with a more consensual model where community leaders and stakeholders come together with the company before the lines are drawn and people discuss it then instead of immediately going to the adversarial face-off. I mean, I think in a lot of cases, these projects could have been built if the local sentiment had been considered from the start.
Hmm. I wonder if that's the case with one of the stories that you describe in this book. It starts with the great scene where a man named Vince Primus in Pepperell, Massachusetts, sort of steps out of his house one day on the way to work and encounters a man working on behalf of Kinder Morgan, who is going to say, hey, look, there's this pipeline. It's going to probably come over your property. Can we have permission to survey your property or at least sign this paper saying you have declined to give us permission? That seemed like one of the more adversarial
exactly.
situations.
And if you don't do it, he says, we can take your land by eminent domain under the laws prevailing in Massachusetts. Yeah, that was a tough situation. Again, if you go back to the principles of property in America, here's property in America. Here's property in motion. Here's someone, you know, in their pursuit of happiness on their land. Here's the quiet citizen having to make way for the exuberantly active one, the one with plans. And that's the battle. And that's the great burden that's placed on these families, is having to show why they, the quiet citizen, have the right for their pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm. So what do these people have in common? Romaine Tenney, Lynn Placey, Vince Primus, what philosophy is driving them?
Well, I would say they believe, A, that property is liberty and property is individual freedom, as the founders did. And they're surprised, upset, and eventually tormented to find out, well, no, your rights are being subjected to the exuberant citizen with plans. You're having to yield, and you're having to bear the burden of a public project or a private project.
Mm-hmm. So let me push back a little bit on the idea of eminent domain, because
sure.
It's hard to say that it's all bad.
Because, which is not what I'm saying, obviously.
Okay.
Obviously, we have to build big projects. But there are other ways to do it without forcing individuals to subsidize big corporations and big things like that. The problem with it is it's in the Fifth Amendment. It's at the tail end of the Fifth Amendment, and it says the public cannot take private land for public use without just compensation. And so, how do you define just compensation? And it's gotten to be defined as market value. Well, in Romaine Tenney's case, what's market value to somebody who loves his farm and loves his land? That's nothing. It really wasn't even enough for him to get set up someplace else.
Mm-hmm. And apparently eminent domain is capable of being used for things like, well, one example I read was that the government used eminent domain against a railroad company in Gettysburg whose railroad owned at least part of the battlefield of Gettysburg that the government wanted to preserve as a sort of memorial to the people who had died there. That seems like a part of eminent domain that may have some decent public benefit.
That one would, but then you have cases where the government is seizing land and immediately turning over to private entities to develop, as it happened in New London with the famous Little Pink House case,
mm-hmm.
She lost.
Not familiar with that case. Can you spell it out really quickly?
Huge development. New London, they wanted to redevelop a neighborhood. They gave all this land over to, I think it was the Pfizer chemical company at the time, a pharmaceutical company. Some folks sued. This woman who owned a Little Pink House sued, went to the Supreme Court. She lost. They said New London had the right to use eminent domain on behalf of a private company. And the idea that it would raise everybody's boats, that was the argument.
Hmm. Peter in Dover.
Quickly stated.
Thank you very much for that. Peter in Dover wanted to know how the language in the New Hampshire Constitution about, quote, life, liberty, and the peaceful enjoyment of property they can purchase works when we think about eminent domain. How do those two things conflict? Howard, what do you think?
They do conflict, and that's always a problem. That's always what we're trying to work out.
Mm-hmm. The conflict between the greater good and the individual's right to enjoyment of property.
Yes.
Yeah. Russell emails. He says, I'm a true believer. Your land is your land. and you should be able to do what you want with it. My neighbor and I each owned 15 acres. He wanted to subdivide and build a few houses. Other neighbors hated it. I didn't like it, but it's his property, and he should be able to do what he wants with it. Thank you very much, Russell, for your comments. Really appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break here, but as we head into the break, let's listen to a little bit of a song inspired by Romaine Tenney, the Vermont farmer who died in a fire he started in his own farmhouse. He did that rather than allow the government to remove him from it to make way for the construction of Interstate 91. This was in 1964, and it generated headlines across the country. Here's the ballad of Romaine Tenney, played by Banjo Dan.
The governor was for it, it was gonna change Vermont. It's just the thing for commerce, it's the very thing we want. If some folks are dislocated, that's the price we'll have to pay. Well, this progress, it's a coming thing, you can't stand in its way. The old codger's just a nuisance, he's stubborn as a mule. He doesn't really mean it, why'd have to be a fool. But the day they brought the dozers was the day the old man died. Set fire to the farmhouse and he locked himself inside. Now the interstate's a fact of life we couldn't live without. We take it all for granted as we madly dash about. And there's very few remember how one man stood his ground. A simple man who kept his word instead of backing down. This property's my birthright and it's here I'll make my stand. Take your money, take your papers, boy, and get off of my land. Won't be no big old highway here as long as I'm alive. By God, I'll stay right here until I die.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and we are talking with Howard Mansfield about property, ownership, and the American dream. His new book is called The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. In this part of the program, we'll talk a little bit about climate change and sea level rise. Do you live on the coast? And do you ever wonder what happens or what will happen to your property when and if your land ends up under the sea? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking a little bit about eminent domain before the break, and we'll continue that conversation just a little bit with a phone call from Eric in Laconia. Eric, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What's your comment?
I just wanted to point out that, you know, eminent domain, heard a lot about the private projects that are going on. But back in 2012 in North Carolina, there was a project to expand a highway called 485 that runs through North Carolina. And they use eminent domain to try and force, you know, 10 plus families out of their homes by paying them what was fair market value and a deflated market to expand it. And it led to a rather large court case and a lot of problems with the community and the local government.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, thanks very much for the call, Eric. So that seems like one of the things you mentioned earlier, Howard, that, you know, yes, they have to provide just compensation to take property, but just is a matter of interpretation.
And this is one of the flaws or the problems with eminent domain is the entity taking your property is also setting the price, even though you can appeal it.
They get to decide what's just.
Yeah.
At least at first.
In fact, this is what the Native Americans, what the Indians faced when their land was seized. The people seizing the white people seizing their land were often setting the price as well. It's a broken marketplace in both cases.
Let's get a call from Pat in West Milan. Pat, thanks very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my name is Pat, and I live right on the West Milan Walpole, New Hampshire town line. And I, after 5 years, have figured out that I have an eminent domain case here, which I cannot get fought because I don't have any money for the lawyers. And I actually got the state of New Hampshire to do a survey in 2016, proving everything I'm saying is true about the improper use of my private property rights to access public land so that a private company can put in a huge quarry behind my house, which is going to run me out of my home and off my land.
A huge quarry by your home. Pat, thank you very much for calling. And it seems like variations on a theme, Howard, people sort of having to fight an entity much larger and better healed than they are to protect something that had already been theirs.
And I would just like to point out, Peter, that this is going on all over the country. If you go down to West Virginia, Virginia, North Carolina, there's two huge pipelines being built. If you look around at things like windmill farms or highway expansions, because there's more Americans, our population is greater, it's harder and harder to build these projects. And there's this huge change going on in the landscape. We're redefining the landscape where industrial uses, which were previously kind of segregated off themselves, are now coming right up against residential uses. And this is one of the great sorting outs that's going on right now. What's going to be saved? What's going to be used? Who's going to be who's going to benefit? And who's going to decide? This is going on everywhere. It just does, we don't draw the lines together. We tend to see it as a local story here, there, and there, but it's a national story.
I want to harken back to something we mentioned before the break. Doug in Mason wrote in to say, please relate the final outcome of the New London case. If I remember correctly, our New Hampshire judge, Justice David Souter, was involved in the decision on that case, and a group tried to seize his New Hampshire property in retaliation, and the property seized was never used for the purpose for which it was taken. That's according to Doug in Mason. Is that familiar to you, Howard?
No, that part of it, the Justice Souter part, is not. I did not know that.
Okay. Well, we want to talk a little bit about climate change and how it relates to property rights. And maybe start this by talking about a place called Doggerland that you wrote about, which, Howard, I guess was at one point not underwater, but it now is. Where is this?
It's in the North Sea, between off Great Britain, and what happened is as the ice caps began at the end of the last little ice age ended and the ice receded, the North Sea began to rise, and the residents of Doggerland were suddenly on a smaller and smaller island until someday, lost in prehistory, maybe like 7,000 years ago, had to decide, do they stay or do they go? And there are people in England today who claim by DNA that they are related to people from Doggerland. Doggerland is now completely underwater. And it was first really discovered when fishermen would pull up in their nets, strange animals. How do the animals get like 30, 40, 50 miles offshore? And then beautiful kind of harpoons made out of bone, almost like Inuit objects. So the lesson for us is essentially we are on Doggerland now. The sea is rising, threatening all sorts of things along the coast, some of our major cities, some of our major historical sites, Jamestown, the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island, you name it. The sea is coming up and we have to face it. And essentially we're like the inhabitants of Doggerland. I'm sure when some of those folks on Doggerland left, some said, no, we're going to be fine. We did this climate change thing isn't really happening. We're staying, and they're lost to history.
So many questions about this. First
yes.
of all, I mean, our legal system is way more complex than whatever they had 7,000 years ago in Doggerland. First of all, let's say that your predictions are correct, and a lot of American cities are going to end up underwater at some point within the next century. Is our government prepared?
No.
I guess that's the easy question. And the second question is, what happens to property rights? If suddenly I have a house that is in Portsmouth and then 100 years from now
it's underwater.
It's underwater. What am I going to rely on?
And do you still have property underwater? And that's what actually there are experts right now, people discussing that right now. I assure you that the insurance companies are very interested and are discussing these issues right now.
Are you entitled to the sort of square of land that is sort of on the surface of the water? Can you park a yacht there or something like that?
Exactly. That'll be the coming debates. That'll be part of the coming debates.
Yeah. Well, what happens? I mean, this kind of seems relevant now when we're hearing news about the California wildfires. I mean, what happens? I mean, this is some might argue a climate change issue as well.
It is.
What goes through your mind when you hear about all these homes in California sort of being reduced to ash and people sort of suddenly having to leave whole towns because the towns are gone?
Well, it's a couple of things that come to mind. One is how we have to stay open to that pain and to understanding what's going on. And the other things we have to understand is that it's just not their problem. It's our problem. And while that's fire, there's all across the country, there are houses and cities in the way of some potential calamity. Another hurricane, big forest fire on the other side of the country, earthquakes. So we have to start putting aside more of our wealth and planning for these disasters and not just reacting to each disaster, but planning to change the way we settle on the land.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you wrote about here is people in Connecticut making an effort to sort of educate people on what might be to come. These people sort of get a taste of it with Hurricane Sandy, apparently. What did you learn from your travels in Connecticut and your interviews done there?
Yeah, the Nature Conservancy has gone along on the entire Connecticut coast and mapped what the coast would look like given a 4-inch rise in the ocean, given a 6-inch rise in the ocean. And you can see exactly, property by property, what's going to be underwater. And you can see how the land around certain marshes, of which there's actually a surprising amount left, how they can migrate inland given the chance if the change happens in the right way, if there's room for them to migrate. So you can look on maps now and see where we should not be building anymore. And you could see on maps where we should be buying the properties out and starting to retreat from the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Rick in Sandwich. Rick, thanks very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. Howard, great to hear you again, as always. I had a question about the public trust and whether or not you covered things like the Supreme Court decision in 1842 that said all of nature is in trust for all of people, and how that can be rectified against the seemingly insatiable drive to develop land without the consideration of the public trust.
What do you think, Howard?
I'm not familiar with that Supreme Court ruling. I think that's, I'll have to look that up. The drive to develop land has accelerated. In fact, in the last, I think, 20 or 30 years, we are developing land at a rate faster than the population is growing by about 20%. So in other words, we're just building out faster and faster, more land, more development, larger projects, which hence goes back to some of the calls we're getting about these conflicts happening all over the place.
Mm-hmm. We got a question sent in by Robin, who asked, what happens to conservation easements when the land is taken over by eminent domain? Do you know, Howard? That might be a very legal question, but...
Yeah, that is a good question. I don't know. I mean, the easement is supposed to go with the land. It's supposed to stand. I don't know. I bet it goes case by case.
Any lawyers out there, feel free to write us in right now, exchange@nhpr.org. Love to try to get an answer to Robin's question.
You can charge your fee to Peter.
Howard, in your book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down, you wrote about finding the good life in an idea you call Broken Town. Tell us about Broken Town.
Yeah, I was going to a particular town to do some reporting, and I was, as you do now, I was looking online and seeing what was on town. And there was a video from one of the real estate brokerages in town and all these people testifying that it's a perfect town. It's a perfect place. It's perfect, perfect. And no place is perfect. And if you think a place is perfect, you're setting yourself up for heartbreak. And I thought, how much better if we regarded all our towns as already broken, as having great happiness but great sorrow, as having great triumph but great setbacks, as having happy people and troubled people. That's the more the totality of human experience, and that's really the way we live. And I come to this from something Mark Epstein, who's a Buddhist and a practicing psychiatrist in Manhattan, said. In the 70s, he was, you know, some of the hippies, as he said, pillaging the East for its wisdom, traveling around, and he ends up in the forests of Thailand, he and these three other people, three Americans, and they're shown in to see this monk, the Ajahn Chah. Little monk, it's a bamboo monastery deep in the forest, and they kind of realize what a strange moment this is. I mean, this monk is looking at these Americans. Why have they come all this way? What do they want? You know, what do they want from me? And they're at such a point, they don't even have the questions yet. And so they say, well, you're a Buddhist. What is this end of suffering? What is this impermanence? What are you talking about? So they don't even have the questions. And the Ajahn Chah very calmly says, see this glass of water? I love this glass of water. I love drinking from it. I love the way the light comes through it in the morning. But this glass is already broken. The wind may knock it over. I may knock it over with my elbow. But this glass is already broken. And it's all the more precious because I know it's broken. And Mark Epstein says, well, that's the world. The world is already broken. And it's all the more precious for that. And that's the same way. That's how we should regard the property that we hold. We could say, if we had a beach house, see this beach house? I love this beach house. I love sitting here with my wife in the morning reading the paper. I love when my children and grandchildren come. But this house is already smashed by a hurricane yet to be named. And yet it's all the more precious for it. And you talked about the fires. You could say that about for all our houses. All that this tremendous change is going to happen. Some of it now accelerated because of what we've added to the atmosphere in terms of carbon. And we regard it as already broken. then we maybe can begin to open ourselves up to accept the idea of change. I think one of the problems we're having with climate change is that we don't even understand change. Mm-hmm. If we could understand change, maybe we could work our way towards a climate science. I don't know. That's just a thought.
Well, that approach, I think, is foreign to a lot of Americans. And I wanted to ask you about the idea of imagining a place that is already broken.
It's very un-American, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in the context of someone like Holly Lovelace, for example, a woman you write about here who literally begged a company to not put a giant electrical station.
It was a compressor station.
Compressor station on her property.
Yes.
Essentially destroy her property and all
forever.
The value forever. Should she not beg that company to not do this and just accept that change is going
to
happen?
That's the interesting thing. You have to make your stand. You have to stand up and fight. At the same time, those kind of fights almost chase out those other kind of qualities, that kind of beautiful brokenness, as Mark Epstein calls it. You have to almost let go of that and fight. You have to hold on. And what you have to do is get back to an idea of stewardship, to use an overused word, but stewardship, where you're more like a relay runner in a race. In field and track, I don't know if you've ever done this, you're given a very slippery aluminum tube and you have to hand it off to the next runner. It's very hard. You have to hold on and at the same moment let go. Hold on, let go. Hold on, let go. It's at that moment where you let go that we're having tremendous trouble as a society. We're having tremendous trouble in the land we manage, in the property we manage, and we're having trouble as a society realizing that we have to let go and prepare for change. We can't do it.
Well, Howard Mansfield, thank you very much for helping us think about property in a new way, in a healthy way. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. I really enjoyed being here.
Howard Mansfield's new book is called The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down, and the conversation about it continues on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, and at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music is composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoi, and I'll be with you tomorrow morning as well for the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.